Wonderful. Hello, fellow timekeepers. We return not as a pair, but we have a bonus interview section, and it's joined by the founders of the Watch Collectors Club, Hamish and Ed, who we're going to introduce a bit later on. And we're delighted to do this because the podcast wouldn't exist without the club. Zach and I actually met at one of their meetups many moons ago, and look what you've spawned, gents. It's quite amazing that we've got a podcast running. So we get under the hood of the club, how it all started and what they plan for 2024 and beyond. And last time out, Zach and I had a great discussion about IWC. And since then, I've been pining for that Petronas green pilot chronograph and even considered swapping it for my blue one, Zach. So watches do funny things to people, don't they? And I also enjoyed our deep dive looking at NATO straps. And again, these chats have meant to go back to the specific areas that we love about watches, you know, and let's just think about whether I want to purchase this or purchase that. So very much enjoyed it. And then this episode, in a couple of minutes' time, is going to take us to Rolex. As I've said before on the pod, I've got a mixed relationship with the brand. So again, I want my sort of, you know, fellow podcasters to come in and perhaps, you know, say something different. But Zach, obviously, as a new owner, can wax lyrical about why he loves Rolex. And then we also have a final section on watch straps. And we're talking about bracelets this time round. Again, I have a bit of an awkward association with bracelets. So again, it will make an intriguing segment. And I'm sure people will differ and have other views, which is definitely what we want on this podcast. Also, briefly, we're up to six episodes now. And that's 6 months in the podcast. And we're doing this slowly, you know, to grow our listeners. And we're opening up, you know, more and more episodes to guests to join us. We're going at our own pace. And we definitely have got that back catalogue in place. So please follow us on Timekeepers 2024 and give us a like. Right, enough pitching, Zach. So what are you wearing today for the wrist check?
So today I have on my Rolex Reference 1500. So I thought it'd be quite fitting to wear that given we're diving into Rolex today. Yeah, it's my most recent purchase. How about you, Tim?
Well, I've actually got my Black Bay 58, so I just slapped it on this morning, but I was getting a bit fed up with my strap choices, so I decided last night to fiddle around with every single watch I own and put new straps on them, so that's what I was doing, and it was more to stop me from buying another watch, so at least I've staved that off for about a month or two at the very least. Right, so should we go for watches we're lasting after? So Zach, over to you.
Yeah, sure thing. So watches I'm lasting over, so... I believe it was last week I traveled to the Patek Philippe exhibition in Bond Street with a friend of mine. Actually, the Patek Philippe exhibition was mentioned by my girlfriend. She kind of noted and prompted us to go. So, I took a friend. And then after we went there, which was an excellent exhibition with loads of unique pieces, enamel dials. So definitely geeked out over there. But then after we went to Burlington Arcade, which was suggested by a friend, of course, as you guys know, lovely vintage pieces over there on display. So we wandered down, I think, to the vintage watch company, and they kindly invited us in and showed us many pieces, mostly Rolex, like, as you know, because I think they're a Rolex specialist. But the watch that caught my eye whilst I was there and has been stuck in my mind since, a 1966 reference 1675 Rolex GMT. I feel like I've always had like a thing for GMTs, especially vintage, but this one definitely stood out to me. I love the kind of like plexi style kind of glass and kind of the patina on the kind of hour markers. And that's definitely the watch that I have in mind and have been kind of lusting over. But how about you, Tim?
Oh, nice. I'm going to pick you up a little bit. You said your girlfriend spotted it. So that's very good. So my wife, she found an advert in the newspaper for, I think it was an Omega watch, and she used it as our rabbit's litter tray paper. That's what she thinks about watches. Wow. So maybe you're onto a winner. And my wife's not the biggest fan of my watch addiction. But there you go. So brownie points to her for pointing out this exhibition that you went to see.
Brilliant.
In terms of what I'm sort of lusting over, so this one's been sort of creeping up on me for months. I've always wanted a Reverso. So Hamish knows that, more than most, I was besotted with the vintage one that he had, the gorgeous cream dial. I dislike sort of reeling off reference numbers, especially on a podcast, but I'm going to make a small exception. So this one was a 250.2.68 from the early 1990s. It's got a black dial and a rose gold case, and it's Art Deco style with gold dolphin hands. I love it, but I worry I won't be able to pull it off, especially rose gold. And I'm not sure how many occasions I'd wear it. And I've not seen it in person, which may change things. I mean, Zach, what do you think? Is I going to pull off rose gold or not?
I feel like when pulling off rose gold and liking rose gold are two different things, certainly. But I think, like, it's, yeah, gorgeous in rose gold, but yeah, I'm not sure if I'll be the person that can do it much justice.
Hamish, Ed, going to bring you in for a bit. You know, do you have a particular watch that you're lusting over? Something that you just really, really want at the moment? And if you had all the money in the world, you'd just go out and buy it?
That's a very good question. There are, I think there's 35 watches on my Chrono 24 wish list at the moment. Not to mention the 40 watches that Subdial has each week. No, I particularly at the moment would like a Breguet Tradition Retrograde Seconds. So they make it with white gold with a sort of dark dial. So for those of you that don't know the Tradition case, it's based on an old Breguet pocket watch with these beautiful sort of suspended bands, wheels and escapement, sort of all open work, so you can see the movement, and it's a real sort of eye-catching piece that just wears really nicely, is finished to Breguet's usual ridiculously high standard. And yeah, for me, I think could be the watch that sort of means I don't need to buy anymore if I ever get one.
Would you have to sell some pieces to get there, though?
Yeah, I'll save for a long time. Currently going for saving for a long time.
Very good. Hamish, what about yourself?
Oh yeah, that was Ed, and I'm Hamish. Hello everyone. I'm more in the micro brand world at the moment. So looking at all the micro brands in the UK especially, there's a few I'm interested in seeing again and maybe making a purchase. So maybe one from Marlow Watch Company and Clemens, which are a really new brand from Edinburgh. I quite like their sort of sporty field watch. And, you know, all those watches are at the more affordable. And so if I sell a couple of watches this summer, which is in process, I'll hopefully buy them before the end of the year, possibly at our watch show.
Very nice, which we'll get onto a bit later on. Cool. Zach, over to you again. We're going to do some Insta shots that sort of grabbed our attention. So what have you got that you just really wanted to sort of shout out to you this month?
Yeah, sure. So I think this week is something slightly different. I came across a phenomenal shot, and this one was from Poker at Pokerlin Beetle on Instagram, so shout out to them. It was a vintage 1940s Omega, which features like a lovely patina dial and a sub-dial, an integrated steel bracelet. And yeah, I think it really stood out to me. So that was one that really made me think, oh man, I need to look back into vintage Omega, because I feel that's where my like first love with watches started, definitely with Omega. And then another shot that I came across that caught my eye was from Watch Leader SKW, and that's also on Instagram, so shout out to them too. And this one was probably more of a, or aligned with what most people kind of look into or have seen when it comes to watches in the watch space online. And it's a Rolex Day-Date 40 olive dial, but this one was kind of interesting and shot differently, like, because especially like on the back of the case, it was not a standard one, but Oman edition, which I thought was pretty cool and captured quite well.
Nice, Zach. I mean, I was looking at you sent me the pictures of them, and that Omega, I couldn't work out what the hands were, like what type of hand. It was almost like a chisel shape. It was very interesting. Yeah. I've never seen any hands like that before. And then obviously on the Rolex, you sort of showed me as well. It's a lot of gold going on. Yeah, I don't know how many people can pull that off.
A lot of rose gold, yeah. So maybe not one to wear, but one to just admire from afar.
It was almost like you're part of like an Arab kingdom or something. It was very like, it was a very royal Rolex, I thought. So there we go. So for me, I always seem to have three. I can never whittle it down. So it was a beauty of a watch shot from, I'm going to pronounce it Left Pain 2, not Left Pain 2, Left Pain 2. And they were showcasing a Universal Genève Cabriolet with a black dial. And he said on his sort of, you know, Insta blurb underneath that it predates the Reverso and the Basculant, and it's the first reversible watch, and that's what he claimed. Maybe Hamish and Ed will correct him, but that's what he was saying. And he's got sort of the watch positioned on the half turn, sort of on its side, with the face sort of at a diagonal, at a sort of 45 degree angle, and it sort of showed off, you know, the sharp angles of the case. So I thought it had great sort of, you know, geometric lines. So that's why it was speaking to me. Another shot that really caught my eye was from Otto Twar watches. Again, unique is overused when we're talking about anything, whether it's, you know, talking about the Euros and the football or, you know, watches. But this was a sort of a triangular collage of watches that he'd sold. Almost think of it as like pizza slices or like, you know, 12 along a dial. And it was an amalgam of different colors, dials, watch straps, brands. And it was such a neat idea. I've never seen anything like it before on Instagram. And like I said, it was like 12 pieces for each hour of the, you know, each hour of the watch. And it's that clever sort of attention to detail that I really appreciated. So definitely check it out if you haven't, and we'll put it up in the links afterwards. And the final one, was from CMQ to, Lancet. And it was a disassembled, Panerai, radio mirror. And I quite like it when people go and disassemble their watches and show all the bits. And it had the strap, buckle and lugs all lined up to attention and taken at a sort of 45 degree angle. So not like a flat lay. Again, simply laid out, but you don't get many shots like that on Instagram. I think it should be applauded for its originality. I don't know, when I sent you them to you, Zach, what did you think? What's the best one that you liked?
I think it's definitely the latter two. So from that, Totti watches with like kind of the pizza slices, very creative, and especially the attention to detail with having each one positioned at each hour, I feel like is exceptional. But then I kind of like the breakdown with the Panerai radio mirror, and that's also quite cool to see it all laid out. I don't think I've come across something like that before. And like as I've, with Panerai, I think visited Panerai recently, I've definitely been looking into some of their models, including the radio mirror. So I think, yeah, the latter two for sure.
We're going to pivot now and we're going to bring Hamish and Ed in properly, and we obviously, like we did with David from the Strap Tailor a few episodes ago, we're going to ask them a set of questions and hopefully they're going to answer them the best they can. And I think, Zach, you're going to kick off with the first question, and then obviously Hamish, Ed, introduce yourselves.
Sure. So first of all, thank you guys for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you on. So I'll start with the first question. So the first question is, how long have you been into watches, and what made you love them so much you wanted to start a members club within watches?
Oh, hey, thank you. Yeah, so I'm Hamish Robertson. I'm the CEO and co-founder of the Watch Collectors Club. And I've been into watches as long as I can remember and collecting them for about 13 years. And it wasn't the love of watches that led us to start the club. It was the frustration with watch events as we found them in London about 6 or 7 years ago. So I moved down to London for work and met Ed in the office when he noticed one of my vintage watches on my wrist, and we got chatting, and obviously we were two enthusiasts talking about watches quite regularly, and he said, have you ever been to a meetup, and took me along to my first watch event. And over time we both found the watch events quite frustrating in different ways, but firstly we were disappointed there were so few of them when there were so many watches to go and see, and we weren't sure how you get invited to brand events and so on and so on. So the real motivation to start the Watch Collectors Club was to run many more and much bigger variety of watch events.
That's a super good answer as well. I feel like I kind of find the same, that I find it the same as well. So definitely coming to your Watch Collectors Club has been like a big game changer in terms of, you know, going to different places, seeing things. They are definitely scarce, but when you find good ones, you kind of lock in. So that's, we definitely found that with you guys. Yeah, hence how this podcast has spawned.
Second one is, how challenging was it to actually gain a foothold in sort of the watch world and the watch community? You know, people have already got some, you know, relatively well-run things, and then sort of you were the new kids on the block, you know, and sort of what were the barriers that sort of you encountered while trying to set it all up?
Yeah, I think, I guess as we've, it's Ed here, co-founder of the Watch Collectors Club with Hamish. As we have grown the club, kind of commercialized it in the last year and really upped the quantity and variety of events that we run, I think it's become slightly easier. So the first few events were hard to get booked in with brands, and Hamish did a fantastic job selling the vision of the club, you know, why we exist, why our members love us, but then also why the brands that we work with, why the boutiques, why the companies we partner with should partner with us. We connect watch lovers with places they can go to love watches, whether that's a brand's boutique, whether it's a vintage seller, whether it's somebody that makes really high-end boxes or really affordable straps. Yeah, we exist to connect those two parties. So as soon as we sort of started to sell that message more and more, we found that we're getting more kind of frequent approaches. But let's not get away from the fact that Hamish spends a lot of time building relationships, nurturing them, calling people, going to shops to ensure that we're sort of front and center. I mean, we have probably run more watch events than anybody else in London. Counted the other day, so over 110 in the last 3 years. And that's with all sorts of different brands and partners. So I guess just finishing off, the key barrier has been getting people to understand that an event is a great thing to run, to connect people together and to connect customers with brands and brands with potential customers, and to get people to take a bet on us.
Yeah, I'd say for sure. I mean, the biggest challenge, which still amazes me and enthuses me in terms of how far we've got to go, is how few people who love watches have ever been to a watch event. How few people have even received an invitation to one. So unlike other categories that we could all immediately think of, like cars and wine and the art world, there's just so little for watch enthusiasts to go to enjoy learning more about watches and meeting other people while doing so. And that doesn't matter which kind of watch you're into, whether you're a affordable watch collector likes micro brands and swatches and things like that, or you're a high horology or gem set watch enthusiast or a lifelong collector of one brand. Like, very few of those people have very few places to go. So the Watch Collectors Club is really our passionate effort to build somewhere that's a home for everybody, so that whatever you're into, you can come along and meet some other people who are equally passionate. Now, you might not like the same things as them, but you can appreciate why they like what they like, hopefully. And if you've never seen something before and you'd like to learn about it, then come to one of our events on that topic, whether it's with a brand or with an expert or at a museum or something like that. So that's really the biggest barrier, is people have no idea that it's such fun. So you guys you found us and you came and you really enjoyed it, and it's really great to hear you say so. But it's the biggest barrier is still getting that message out there that it's a fun way to spend an evening or a weekend, for our weekend events. And that's genuinely the biggest barrier, is just how much fun you can have going to talk about watches and see watches and try them on and learn about other people's passion for them as well.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It's a really good point, actually. I hadn't necessarily thought it like that, because I know you can have like car meetups where you might bring your own car, but most often than not, you don't necessarily bring your own car for wine. You don't bring your own wine. It's a bit weird. You don't bring your own art, but you can bring your own watches, for something like this. So, and obviously other people will bring theirs, and you can live sort of vicariously through people. So that's a really good point.
Yeah. Or we go to the retailers and we can see the amazing products that all these different brands, big and small, are making. And we can learn about them and try them on without any barriers, without any stuffiness, without any worry that there's no sales pressure. It's just, go and enjoy the space that the retailers created, which are all quite different, and enjoy the range that they've got to offer. And if it's not for you, you've still, had a good evening, met some nice people and learnt about that place. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit like, in that sense, there's art galleries, there's, wine bars and wine tastings. But in the watch world, there's no group and community stuff, or hardly any.
Again, I'd just like to sort of say the reason why I like the club so much is actually how sort of unstuffy it is. I've been to a few other events, or just other things, and it just feels very upper echelons, sort of very sort of, certain access and not access to other things. But you guys make it very open, just what I quite like. So just definitely thumbs up from me, and I'm sure, Zach, you'd say the same thing.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. When I first kind of stumbled across, I think it might have been through something on Instagram, so maybe Hamish's efforts, but yeah, when I came along, I instantly made multiple connections and realized it was nothing that I'd intended before when it comes to watches, that's for sure.
That's great to hear, and it's something that we try really hard to make sure is the case for absolutely everybody that comes to every one of our events. So you know, we don't care whether you've got one watch or 100 or, you know, whatever they are. It doesn't really matter. You know, we have people who collect Seikos or Casios or Patek Philippes. You know, we are there for everybody, and we're there to build a community for people who are curious about watches. So it's, yeah, great to hear that you've both had great experiences with us.
People once had watch forums, then Instagram, now TikTok. What makes an in-person activity work in 2024 and beyond, would you say?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the way we see it is that the last 15 years of the online communities, where they've sort of come out of forums and onto social media, is actually been a bit of a detriment, because we've moved back from the forum era of watch collecting, which was a lot of people sharing knowledge with each other and a lot of engagement. And now with YouTube and short video contact dominating, it's about broadcast. And I'm aware I'm saying that on a podcast, which is also a broadcast channel. And it's not that the information isn't there, because a lot of the great content online and on podcasts is full of really interesting information, but there's no opportunity for people to engage. It's like, engage in the comments or send us an email to tell it, give us your feedback and thoughts, please. And that's fine. But we see the next stage in, you know, the role of technology and the internet bringing people together is to help us find the people who do want to be a community and come in person when they can. And then when we run online events, we want to make sure that they're, it's not just me and Ed podcasting. It's an online talk where everyone has a chance to ask questions, either on the topic we're debating that day or if we've got a guest on at our online event. And at all our in-person events, the other thing that we offer, as well as making sure that everyone has a good time and feels welcomed and included, is we try and offer an educational component. So what's really interesting about the traditional events in the watch world is, say, a brand would invite one of their celebrities or influencers to come along, and that would be the attraction for the attendees. And Ed and I always found that baffling, because, like, surely if you're getting 50 people into your store, the focus should be on the watches, not some random person that you somehow ended up with as an ambassador. And, you know, we all have opinions on that in the watch world. So what we want to try and do at our events is always add that extra little bit of information. So obviously, if it's on a brand or a particular watch, then I might give a talk or we might interview someone from the brand live. And it's not, again, it's not so that people are being broadcast at, it's to help people ask their own questions while we're there. So I'm not standing there for half an hour going on and on and on about the history of some brand. I'm giving a short, sharp, interesting talk to open up conversation for anyone who's maybe not quite confident enough to ask their own questions of the brand's representatives. And then at our own events, we'll also do informative talks. Both Ed and I have given quite a few different topics. And again, just trying to find a way to maybe address a group of a lot with a lot of different knowledge bases, but always put something interesting in there for everyone so they can hopefully leave feeling they've learned a little bit of something from the evening about that topic. And we think that by adding that level of a little bit extra to our events, done in the right way, really helps that in-person idea and why you should go to an event. You know, what are you going to get out of it? It's like, well, okay, worst case, let's say you didn't like the watches and didn't meet anyone you got on with, you still might have learned something. So it's kind of what's next is, yes, we can keep using technology and we can try and think of, and hopefully technology will allow us to do even more interesting interactive events online for a wider watch community that aren't based near London, because that's where our events are currently, because that's where we live. But it's really just thinking about, okay, well, maybe people are a bit sick of broadcast. Like, yes, you've got your three favorite YouTube channels or three favorite podcasts, but actually, maybe if you took the time away from one of them and went, you know, once or twice a month to a community gathering like ours, it might really open up a different part of the watch world and a different way to appreciate and enjoy watches. So that's what we're aiming for.
I'd add to that. Brilliant. Yeah, we all spend a lot of time looking at things and, you know, digesting all of this information and opinion, but we feel really strongly that it's sort of time for people to get away from being just behind a screen, whether that's YouTube or Instagram, and start getting hands-on with watches. You know, they are tactile goods that fit you or they don't. You like them in the flesh or you don't. So we exist to turn those pictures on the screen into things that you can explore, touch, try out. I'll give you a great example of how my mind was changed totally at one of our events, actually. IWC watches. I loved them in the pictures, but I read the description, 44 millimeters, 46 millimeters, 48 millimeters, and said, I can't wear that. That's way too big. We did an event with IWC sometime last year, and every single watch I tried, I went a size up. You know, the watch I loved the most was a 48 millimeter, which is that's a big watch. You know, you'd usually say, crikey, that's, you've got to be a rugby player to wear that. Having never bothered to go into an IWC store, I didn't know that was a size that fit me or worked for me. And I now know that, okay, if I like something, go to an event, get into a store, try it on, make a kind of informed decision whether I like it or not.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, I went for the 41 for the IWC Pilot Chronograph. I didn't think I could pull off the other ones. Just Hamish, to your point about ambassadors, I mean, if you got Roger Federer along, you know, I think, you know, all bets are off. You might even sort of quadruple the amount of members you have. So never say never. Depends who it is.
Well, if he's... yeah. I mean, there's if they're watch enthusiasts, sure.
Yeah, I don't know if he is, but he gets paid to show some interest, doesn't he?
I like what you mentioned as well about the educational piece, and I was kind of like relating it to other watch events I've been to, and it's true. You kind of get people in the room, and then maybe you have a glass of champagne or you get a drink, and then it's very much kind of like, okay, we've got you in the room. Here's our brand. Here's the history, which I guess is quite, you know, interesting, but then it's kind of it's kind of like giving a basic level of, okay, here's where we are, this is what we do, but then that's something that you kind of look into anyway. But kind of that piece of education is definitely, and the talks you give, like for example when we had the one in Bishopsgate, I think Watches of Switzerland, I think it was, that was really good, like the breakup of talk to tell people, okay, about the dial and swap watches, which allows people to engage more and, like, you know, kind of like evoke some sort of, or provoke some sort of conversation. It really definitely adds a unique element. So yeah, I think that's spot on.
To the next question. So it's to both Hamish and Ed. I don't know who wants to answer first, but what's your favorite thing about a watch? So, like, you know, in the podcast we run, we do a particular thing, like we talk about watch crowns or dials or whatever. You know, I particularly quite like crowns of a watch, but is there something that, of all the whole thing about a watch, is there one thing that just really stands out for you that always draws your attention or that you look at first when you're admiring a watch?
I'm a dial lover. So a case can be clunky and ugly. If it's got a beautiful dial, it's the watch for me. So I like, and it's a variety of things on the dial. I appreciate it's the biggest part of a watch that you look at. You know, it's the bit that is the most functional. It's how time is displayed. But I like, in particular, the finish of a dial and the way that the indices or numerals, whatever segmentation of time is applied to the dial. For me, that's the most sort of aesthetically interesting part of a watch.
So Ed, you're saying it's all about her face, not her body.
Exactly.
Hey, what about you?
Yeah, kind of similar, actually. I mean, I'm very design sort of focused in what I like. So design first, and then heritage that's gone into the brand and or watch, I think, second for me. I do like hands as well. So, you know, like, I don't, like, if I think about it, there's definitely hands I don't like. And I think I was thinking about this when I was sort of thinking through these questions before. Like, I don't like a lot of the more famous models of watch. Like, I don't really like, I'm not that interested in most Rolex Submariners, most Omega Speedmasters, most Patek Philippe Nautilus watches. But of the few I do like, there's always something slightly unusual about them. And it's, you know, something to do with the design of the dial and hands that makes that difference in this example. So that's what I'm really looking at, dial balance, what the design inspiration of that dial is. Was it practical or was it aesthetic? And then, yeah, the hand shape.
Yeah, I quite like hands as well. I think the Breguet style hands, I've got one on a sort of a vintage Omega. I quite like that style. I mean, they don't really make that many interesting hands anymore in my mind. I think when you go back to like 20s, 30s, 40s, there was lot more of a choice.
I think they've slightly spoiled it by putting like loom requirements. So if you think about it, like, that's why there's so many straight long hands on modern watches, because they want to put a lot of loom in there. But we're starting to see, I mean, come on to this, I guess, later, but we're starting to see more risk being taken there and more interesting hand design. You know, so fingers crossed we get a lot more.
Awesome. I think with that one as well, it's quite tricky. I feel like it's definitely a combination of things, but I think, as Ed mentioned, the dial, like the contrast of the dial with the watch material, the, you know, the case material and colour, I think that's what kind of wins it to me, wins it for me. But moving on to the next question I had. So where do you see the wider watch community going in the next few years, age, gender, styles, watch sizes?
I think probably looking at where we've been recently is a good place to start. And we were very lucky to have Joanna Langer from the FHH. I won't murder the French pronunciation of that foundation, come and talk to us about watch trends. And she pointed out what's been happening in the last kind of couple of years, and I guess three key things. Complications, so people are more willing to have complicated watches again. Color, so watch trends, watch colors tend to follow fashion trend colors. So I guess expect lots of khaki watches next year. And then thirdly, a sort of diminution in size of watches, which makes them accessible to a broader range of people, of slightly more unisex. Those three things for me are really exciting. So complicated watches I love, and it's not just the really high-end complications, but it's simple things, more simple things like chronographs, power reserves, etc. Colors, you know, we've seen hundreds of different colors of watches released in the last month alone, by all sorts of different brands. And I love the fact that lots of these brands that we love are starting to recognize that they don't need to make the one watch that somebody buys. They can make one of the watches that somebody buys, and that allows them to be kind of more whimsical with their design. And then thirdly, this sort of decrease in size is great. I share lots of watches with my wife, who is a watch collector as well. That's possible because many brands are making watches in that sort of 36 to 38 to kind of a slim 40 millimeter size, which fits more closely than our two different wrist sizes.
I really agree with all that, unsurprisingly. I'd also add high horology and watches over 25,000 Swiss francs or US dollars, which are roughly equivalent, are the highest growth segment of the market. And it's not unreasonable to believe that wealthy people will keep buying expensive pieces of jewellery, regardless of the economic circumstances, because they are really quite fashionable and mentioned a lot, you know, and it's seen as having a great timepiece is seen as really important to create a great outfit. And this is good for everyone. So it's good for all the people who can't afford a timepiece like that, because that spending does promote innovation across the top of the industry. It promotes spending on an investment in new technology, new movement design, new case materials, new dial materials as well. And that does trickle down. So whatever you think about where the money trickles down, technology does trickle down. It gets cheaper over time, and then more brands can use these interesting things. And we've seen that in the last, well, all the decades of the watch industry, of course, as technology has been invented, it's been spread across the industry. But the continued investment in interesting new movements, interesting new finishes, interesting new materials for cases at the high end does trickle down to the more affordable pieces. And we're seeing it. We're seeing brands who previously were thought of as very low end and humble beginnings, you know, trying to make interesting complications. We're seeing brands of all stripes try and outdo each other on case finishing, you know, and the quality of case, you know, making basically even as something as simple as making a stainless steel case with a lot of different angles on it and polishing that correctly has historically been very expensive, but that's gotten a lot cheaper. And that's the benefit of people designing at the micro brand level or just starting out. Mm-hmm. So all these things that are happening and driven by the high end of the watch market will trickle down. And the good news is that while the overall watch market is slow and possibly even falling, shrinking, the high end is still growing quite fast, and that actually benefits all us enthusiasts because we'll see the benefits of that.
It's a bit like cars, I guess, as well. Someone's always going to keep buying the Porsche 911 and keep buying the Aston Martin, so hopefully you think it trickles down to other cars as well. Cool, so moving to the next question. So how has the marketing side of the club developed since you started? Obviously, you must have tried a number of things and then it be successful or something's not be successful and then you've had to change tack. So just maybe that journey that you've gone on from the beginning to where you are now and perhaps the things you want to do in the future.
Yeah, so it's been tough. So well, it's really difficult to stand out. Now, that's true for all new businesses and new ideas, but it's particularly tricky for us in one way. Because we want to be an inclusive club for everyone who's curious and no matter what kind of watch they're into. So we can't say anything controversial. We can't say anything derogatory or start having very strong opinions about watches and brands because we know that everybody likes some of those brands and so they're welcome in the club. And so what we focused on is trying to focus on telling people, you know, what we do, where we do it, why we do it, and how much fun they can have. We've tried to use social media, which again has been, we've had a few hiccups. We got locked out of one account, which was not our fault and very irritating. But that's, again, challenges of a young business and getting started. And now what we're doing is trying to find a lot more partners to work with, to tell people about what we're doing. So the obvious partners, so businesses in the watch industry, can they tell their customers about us? And marketing through them, in effect, in return for, you know, we'll try and make some commercial partnerships out of this, but we're really looking into that. And then, of course, it's just, you know, doing some more media outreach and doing podcasts like this. And then the most exciting thing that we're trying this year, which is a big deal, is running the Manchester Watch Show in November to raise our profile amongst watch enthusiasts in the UK in general. And then obviously have a great show on the day for people in Manchester or near Manchester, but really just to help build the profile of the club in that way as well. So we always hope and, well, we know and we've seen our events that have been really popular, have driven growth and interest in the club, and we're just trying to extend that. So really trying to extend organic marketing by doing more and more interesting and ever larger events.
It's tricky, isn't it, trying to start out? And I think the way, you know, Zach and I were trying to do this podcast, we certainly have strong opinions about what we do and don't like for watches, but we try and talk about what we love about watch brands, even if we don't, you know, love them dearly on everything that they ever do. So hence why we want to move on to Rolex. I'll pick out some things I do like and others can come in and say why they absolutely love them. So Zach, next question for you.
So tell us about your trip for the club to Watches of Wonders earlier this year, and this is actually an interesting question because I actually bought a ticket to Watches of Wonder but couldn't make it out there because I had some other things I had to look after, but I did kind of have a look and it looked like a brilliant time. So yeah, if you let us know a bit how that went with the group.
Well, you should have gone with Hamish Ned straight away. Yeah, they can chastise you now and say what you missed. Yeah,
I was gonna say, you generally missed out. It was a great a few of our members had said last year, actually, are you guys thinking of going? Don't have anyone to go with. How about we go together? And we kind of asked a few more of our members, and a lot of them turned around and said, you know what, I've always fancied going, but I don't want to go on my own because I don't know what it's like. There's not very much information. So what would be really handy is if someone could go and organise everything for me and get us in with brands and what have you. So that's what we did. And Hamish did a fantastic job, actually, of getting us behind the kind of velvet rope, which I think lots of people probably don't understand about these big shows is that they're predominantly trade shows. So Watches and Wonders has only been open to the public for a couple of years. So they're actually set up for the big wholesalers and the big retailers to go and see all of the new releases and this sort of public display for the final 2 days of the week. It is a relatively recent thing. And so the brands are still very much not into having people kind of in their stands and handling watches. And so if you want to go and try stuff on, you have to either know somebody or find somebody who knows somebody and pre-organize it. So I think there's about 18 of us went. We had sort of five or six appointments every day. We went to a couple of the shows around Watches and Wonders, because it's not just Watches and Wonders. The whole city is hosting sort of three or four other events. So there's a very famous one at the Beau Rivage Hotel. There's another event for sort of smaller brands just outside of the center of town on the Friday. So we went to both of those. We did a tour of the Patek Philippe Museum. We had loads of these little experiences around the 2 days of the show that we went to that made it sort of a really fun and enjoyable first introduction to what is the biggest and greatest watch show in the world. And it's something that we'll continue to do now on a yearly basis. We're also looking at going to some of the other shows around the world as well. But for anyone that wants to come to Watches and Wonders with us next year, we'll be advertising our sort of package for it at the start of next year. It's a really fun way of seeing the city, making some new friends. We've now got members in Switzerland and the United States who joined the club just to come with us, and we look forward to seeing them again next year and if they're ever in the UK. Is there anything you would add, Hamish?
Yeah, I'd just add that it was a truly awesome experience. We wrote a detailed blog post about our experience there, which you can find on our website, and we called it The Ultimate Guide to Watches and Wonders, because I'm sick to death of seeing journalists moan about going and talk about how they're slightly disappointed / bored by the whole experience, when for any watch enthusiast, it is a fantastically fun experience and an extraordinary one at that, to see what a very high-end industry does when it wants to present itself to the best degree. And it was huge fun just wandering around looking at the stands that the companies had built, how they present themselves, what they'd chosen to highlight before we even got to looking at any watches up close. And you know, to a jaded journalist, they don't say anything like that, but that alone is fun. And then, yeah, as I'd said, we got a group. It was 14 enthusiasts plus Ed and I, and we had a really great time going around together. Obviously, we were sort of all did things at different pace when what people wanted to see, but we arranged those opportunities for them to do things, and then we arranged dinners in the evening as well for everyone to come to and share their experience of the day and share their passion for watches. So it was absolutely fantastic time we had, and we're very excited to be going back. So yeah, do check out the blog post if you want, or more of the technical details about the show and what we did, but we can't wait, to be honest. And you know, the larger the club gets, the more of these things we'll be able to go to. So next year we might try and go to Dubai as well towards the end of 2025. But we're definitely hoping to go to we will be at Watches and Wonders Week again in the spring.
That sounds really good. I don't think my wife would ever allow me to go unless perhaps I signed something in blood and then gave it to you that I wasn't allowed to buy a watch. So if that does happen, then you'll have to carry it in your top pocket and then present it to me every time I get lured in by something. So maybe that's the deal I'm going to have to strike. I don't know about you, Zach. Would you be allowed out?
Yeah, I think we'll have a conversation. I'm sure that will be all right. Yeah.
You're not married yet, but when that happens, you might not be allowed out.
Not just yet, but we'll see.
Well,
I think work something out.
Just bring the wife. So three of them go with their wives.
Yeah. You had a brief mention of Manchester, and I thought that would be quite a good trip. Why not?
Manchester is designed, might as well mention it now. So November the 9th this year, Saturday afternoon, it's designed for people to do in a day trip, both the brands and the attendees, if they want. So there'll be two sessions to buy tickets for, one's from 12 till 2:30, the others 2:30 till 5, which should give you plenty of time to get to the city and back. And yeah, it's hopefully 25 watch brands. We've got 19 signed up so far, all British, and should be a really fun watch show. Yeah,
that sounds awesome. That sounds really awesome. I'll definitely be looking out for that one.
But why Manchester? Because of your Liverpudlian roots, you know, is that a crime that you've committed against your people?
I don't think so on this occasion. I think Manchester is, you know, the centre of the north in terms of transport links, and that was it, really. There's 20 million people within 2 hours of Manchester, roughly speaking.
Yep.
And, you know, the north of England is perennially ignored by many in the watch and luxury and fashion industries. So we want to really do a show up there, see how it goes. You know, it's the first one. It's the first time anyone's tried anything like this with watches. So we'll see how it goes. We're not just assuming it's going to be a huge success. There's a lot of work to do to make that happen, but we're really excited to go there. And, you know, in an ideal world, there'd be many shows of different sizes for watches and watch brands of different kinds in the north of England. So can I do something in Liverpool one day? Yeah, I'd absolutely love to. And I've already talked to a brand last week about doing something with three brands in Liverpool. So, you know, again, we really want to start doing that kind of thing. If brands want to go somewhere, we want to, you know, really try and make it happen. So Manchester first, and we'll see what happens after that.
No, very, very good. Like, I married a Scouser and I've fallen in love with the city as well. So I do love Liverpool. And this is coming from a Man United supporter as well. So Hamish doesn't hate me as well as a United fan. And obviously, he's a Liverpool fan. So it's all good banter here. All good banter. So the next question is, so do you have any plans to take members to sort of auctions? I think you may have done it in the past, but I wasn't able to make it. I've never been to an auction myself, and I'd really love to understand how it all works. You know, have a talk beforehand, meet the organisers and stuff. I mean, in the future, if you're planning to do that, then I'll definitely come along.
Yes, we do. Yes, it's been slow to come about, but I'm pleased to say that we will be doing an event right before the Watchers of Knightsbridge auction in November, later this year. And I've got a call with another auction house in the diary for this week, Thursday. And so we're starting to make those connections. We haven't managed anything with the large auction houses. And I think it's just slightly we haven't been on their radar yet. It's not been for lack of trying. So hopefully in future we'll be able to work with them as well and do some previews when they do their big watch auctions. But it's a funny, I have some sympathy because when the big houses put on these big auctions, they have to, you know, for those who don't know how auctions work, like they spend an amazing amount of time drumming up clients directly. That's where their time goes. So, you know, they not only have to get the consignments for the auction to make the auction interesting, but they then literally go out and find the buyers, and there's a lot of time that's very time consuming. So I do appreciate that, but hopefully, yeah, we think it's a great channel to buy at. Both Ed and I have bought watches at auction before. We think there's a lot of good deals if you're willing to do the research and take the time, and it's where a lot of watch dealers buy from as well, not all but many. So I think it's definitely a channel anyone interested in pre-owned watches should understand and learn more about, and we're hopefully going to be able to help this year and then more in future.
Perfect. So what is the main future goal for your business, would you guys say?
So the simple answer is to take the Watch Collectors Club to everywhere in the world people like watches. So we start here because we live here. And so we'll aim to conquer the UK and really get a really vibrant community and club going in the UK first, with online events for those who want to participate from a bit further apart. We keep the prices very accessible. Membership starts at £75 for a whole year. And really, we want to be that place where people can come and just find people to enjoy watches with, to, you know, further their curiosity, come to our events and see loads of great watches in the metal, in real life. Learn what really drives other people in their collecting, and yeah, see how your passion for watches expands after you come to our club. I mean, we never know what's going to get brought along to any event, and it's always incredibly varied. And it is just such a joy to see that. You know, when we share our collections, people have never seen a watch. We have new people coming along all the time, and then we work with the experts, the brands, etc., to see their watches. But the goal is to take that as far as we can take it. Our short-term target, which we tell everyone, is 1,000 members, which we're not close to yet, but we're really excited to get to 1,000 members. And after that, it's how big can we get?
Awesome, awesome. Yeah. I mean, I don't doubt that happening at all. The rate, I mean, it's impressive to see the growth thus far.
Yeah, don't lose the faith. And I suppose do a bit of a shout out. So social media channels where people can find you, that kind of thing, where they can sign up, www.etc. Floor is yours.
Yeah, so there's a variety of places you can follow us. So we have a website, thewatchcollectorsclub.com. So there you'll find, I guess, there's two key pages to look at. The first is our events. So we don't expect people to pay for a membership before they come and try us out. So you can attend a couple of events for free. So all of our events are there for you to sign up. We'll always have 5 or 6 listed, but there'll be lots more organised. We just only have 5 or 6 listed at any one time. The second is our blog page. So we write a blog kind of every other week at the moment, but we've been doing it for years, and we used to write at least weekly. So there's literally hundreds of watches, hundreds of blogs, which are designed to help you get the most out of the watch world. So they're really sort of easy to read, educational posts. We've then got an Instagram, which is at the watch CC, and a Twitter, which is at the watch CC, and a Facebook, which is the Watch Collectors Club. We're probably most active on Instagram and Twitter of those two. We also have a Threads channel and a YouTube channel, so you'll find us on YouTube at the Watch Collectors Club. We don't post there very often, but we're starting to do more of that over the summer.
But not TikTok. I'm showing my age. I really have no idea what it is and how it will work. So I don't know, Zach, given your age, because you're a tad younger than us, are you a TikTok dabbler, even if that's the phrase?
I'm definitely not. But maybe I'm missing a trick, because I hear that it's like quite engaging and interesting. So.
So we're going to move over to talk about Rolex. Hamish and Ed are going to stay on the line, and we'll bring them in at various points to sort of, you know, add their experience and views on this. So I'll kick it off. I'll try and set the scene as best I can. And like I said, please do disagree with me. This isn't all just about what I do and don't like. It's about, you know, people we have on, and obviously Zach, I think you'll speak a bit more positively than me on the Rolex. But let's get into it. So obviously, it goes without saying, they're the most well-known, dare I say, aspirational brands. You know, people want to own a Rolex. I've got a lukewarm appreciation for them. It's probably sacrilege, especially on a podcast that's talking about watches. Would I want one? Sure. But why do I want one? Is it the hype? Is it the status? Are they even the right reasons? They are probably the wrong reasons. But this podcast is about love of watches. So this is not going to be a diatribe. How people come to, you know, the watch community, they're driven by different things, and you also encounter a wide range of people. Personally, I do find Rolex a bit sort of bland and samey. For example, you know, people talk about getting a Pepsi and then they would, you know, want a Batman or a Starbucks. But for me, they're the same. You know, I can't get my head around that. But other people will see very different. But I'm going to stop there with the doing down. And I'll talk about what I do love about them. So Lollipop Klaxon again. I love the Lollipop secondhand. And obviously they've got that on the Submariner. So no surprises, it's an icon. I also prefer more of their vintage pieces. The bubble backs from the 1940s and 50s. I mentioned in a previous pod that I let one of those slip through my fingers for a crazy low price. You know, it had a coin edge bezel with blue steel hands and had a great sort of salmon patina to the dial. And there's one I'm following very closely at the moment. It's dated from 1945. It's bimetal, rose gold and steel, but it doesn't have the blue steeled hands, unfortunately. But maybe one day I'll bite the bullet and add one to my collection. But Zach, what do you think about bubble backs?
It's funny, you mentioned that actually, Tim, about the Rolex bubble back, because I remember actually telling me sometime back the story with that specific Rolex bubble back. But regarding Rolex and their bubble backs, I actually had a friend who actually put me on to them. A friend called Sean, and he's also an avid collector, and he basically pointed it in my direction, and I was quite amazed because I didn't usually find much people online who were wearing them or in person, so it was quite cool to see. I do like them, like you mentioned. I kind of feel like they represent great value also, you kind of mentioned as well. I'm also more into vintage rather than modern watches, as I believe they have more of a story attached to them, a narrative, which kind of makes them more interesting and more unique, I'd say. I also like the sizing as well. It's funny because Ed kind of mentioned sizing when he spoke about IWC. Sizing is kind of a big thing to me. And I kind of feel like with the new Rolex models, they're slightly bigger and more saturated. But the likes of the bubble back and vintage, they're slightly smaller, which is kind of what I look at more so in terms of watches that suit me.
Hamish, Ed, would you have a modern Rolex or would you have a vintage Rolex? Ed, do you want to go first?
So my wife has got a modern bimetal Explorer, which I cheekily wear quite a lot. I really love the robustness of the modern Rolex. You know, there's little that you can't do with it. I've always said I'm going to save my first Rolex purchase, as my wife did, for a kind of special one. And for me, that means a gold one. So as soon as I can get a garish gold Rolex, I will get one. But I don't think that's going to be for a little while. And then on the vintage side, there is one that I've long had my eye on. And as with all things watches, you should buy these watches as soon as you see them, because they will obviously just go up in value. So a guy that I met called Chris Boone at a watch event years ago, he was a very avid Speedy collector, but he was sort of getting into the really quirky Rolex reference numbers. And he showed me what I still think is the coolest vintage Rolex, which is a transitional model Sea Dweller. And the reference number is 1660. So it's called the 666. They did a Mark 1 and a Mark 2. They're both awesome. So I'd have one of those at some stage. Unfortunately, the price has slightly more than doubled since he introduced them to me. So, yeah, lesson learned.
I love that you've wandered off into Rolex nerddom there, Ed. You're not that big of a fan of the brand. I mean, I'm not that big a fan of the brand because I don't really like any of their modern watches much. Maybe the 1908. I haven't had a chance to see one in the metal yet or try one on. I think the brand is absolutely extraordinary, and I can go on and on about the history of the brand and their incredible marketing success and how the fact that the founder Hans Wilsdorf is not more well known, despite how well known the brand is, I think is a great shame, because he is one of the world's greatest ever marketing visionaries and entrepreneurs. Yes, there's plenty of great entrepreneurs that people talk about nowadays, past and present, but he's not talked about enough. The success he had building that company, the place he left it in, the culture he gave it, the values it has today in terms of quality, maintaining quality, and how to sell quality, how to sell luxury, how to sell quality. It's just outstanding. And I love everything about that part of the brand, but I don't love their modern watches. I do like some vintage Rolex. I have two, one now, sold one, the other one's for sale. Oysters, small Oysters from early 1950s, super subtle, great looking, really great condition. Basically no one would ever know it's a Rolex unless you get close enough to see the small Oyster case, which, you know, it's still exactly the same case then today as it was then, which is fantastic. And again, an indicator of how they do things. I think for me, if I were to own another one anytime soon, it's very unlikely. But yeah, if I won the lottery, I would get the first gold sub, the first gold Submariner. Just, I really like its proportions, and I really like what an absurd watch it was and is to make a 200-meter water-resistant watch out of solid gold at the end of the 1960s was an absurd thing to do, and it still is. So, and if you buy one that they have serviced recently, it will still be waterproof to 200 meters.
No, thanks for that, both. So pivoting to another one that's also very famous, the original Explorer. And for me, it's sort of the pinnacle of a watch for me. It's perfect in every way. I sort of particularly like the classic sort of numeric font they use. I think the more modern numbering is dreadful. Sorry, Ed, just not a big fan. It's like something from the 1980s, and I don't particularly like that decade either. So I think they should turn back the clock. And go back to how they used to make it. I know the issue is the prices for them are crazy high, but it is Rolex after all.
It's the longest made reference. So the 1016, is it? Is the 25 years of manufacturing that one reference. So you can find one for a reasonable amount of money. And it's not the original. It's not series one or two or three of the Rolex Explorer, but it's the same font as far as I'm aware. So if again, that speaks to why people might want to think about pre-owned or vintage watches rather than buying new, is if you buy well, you've got an incredibly good quality watch. They're accessible when they've made as many as they did that one, and B, they're more affordable perhaps.
Definitely. Zach, what about you? Explorers, modern or vintage?
I love Explorers, modern and vintage. But if I had to pick, I'd definitely go vintage. I think it's probably a touch on what Hamish mentioned about them, the vintage ones or the pre-owned ones being a bit more attainable than the new ones. Not that the new ones are at a crazy price point within Rolex. I mean, from the outside in, it is still expensive. It's still a Rolex. I'm also a big fan of the Rolex Explorer, the Blackout. edition. I feel like that kind of like adds a bit of a variation from the standard one four two seven zero. I also feel like whether it's a 36 or 39 mil, they both kind of well phenomenally well, and I quite like that black contrasting dial with the kind of silver kind of steel finish with the bracelet.
Very good. So we'll move to Datejust. So Zach, you lead on this, given your almost near purchase of one of them.
Sure. So I'll start with Datejust then. If we're not talking about Submariners when it comes to Rolex, we're usually talking about Datejust, I kind of feel. The Datejust, I feel like, is quintessentially Rolex. Often people prefer the vintage two-tone, but I much prefer the steel variant. At 36 millimeter, I feel like it's the perfect size, but maybe I'm slightly biased. And when it's paired with a classy strap as well, I feel like it's the perfect watch for any formal occasion. I was actually very close to buying a Rolex Datejust recently, but my only reservation was the fact that they're quite common, especially like the secondhand vintage ones. Which kind of led me to gravitate towards the classic reference 1500 OP, as I found it a bit more unique and understated. But I'm also a fan of the new OPs, as you all know, the different colours, very playful, some a bit harder to get. My preference would be in the 36 millimetre. I'm not really fussy at all when it comes to colours. Usually it's probably slightly easier to get the blue or black dial, but it would be a nice bonus if you could get a different coloured dial, like the green or coral, but I don't think I've ever seen that. I kind of feel like it's gold dust. It's gold dust to get one of those, but how about you, Tim?
Yeah, I mean, I almost like the petrol mint green OP Datejust, which they released a few years ago. I've read a few articles, I've seen on social media, and lots of people dislike it. But I think with my off-piste Rolex views, that's probably why it's no coincidence I do actually like it. You know, I love sort of green dial watches, and that's probably why I'm drawn to it. I just wish they went back to those sort of engine turn bezels of yesteryear, not the ones they use now. But again, I'm being a bit fussy. What about, Zach, you know, talking about day dates as well?
Sure. Well, with day dates, I feel like day dates are the pinnacle when it comes to Rolex. I feel like many people who are kind of playing the long game of speaking to a Rolex dealer and finally getting a watch tend to work their way up to the day date. I feel like the price point of the newer models when it comes to day date are quite significantly high. So I think like Hamish mentioned something about lottery. So I kind of feel like I need a significantly more amount of money to disposable income to get one. But I'd actually say that I'd probably sway to, because of that fact, probably sway to more the vintage, because I feel like they represent great value. I had a friend that a couple of years back purchased a white dial, solid gold day date. And I think it was, I think between 11 and 12K, I think it must have been 12 or 12.1K, which is a lot for watch, but for a day date that, you know, I think looks pretty similar to the new one, despite the dial, I feel like that's kind of the way to go. But yeah, what's your kind of thoughts on the day date, Tim?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a bit of a struggle because the day dates for me destroy symmetry. Firstly, the date window, and then obviously slapping the day at the top. So it wouldn't be the watch for me. However, I do like the latest green dial ones, similar to the Just Dates, because they're often sort of like in Sunray style, like blasted style. So a bit like the OWC Pilot Chronograph, which I adore. We're going to canter through some of the other models they have. So. We're going to talk about Submariner. I mean, you know, what else could be said about Submariner? It's sort of the iconic watch. It's James Bond's watch, for God's sake. You know, it's every boy's dream to wear one. This little boy's dream to wear one probably as well. You know, you look at that watch and you think 007. You know, you've got the red triangle, the bezel, the lollipop second hand, the loom. You know, would I probably trade everything in for that James Bond watch? Maybe, you never know. But in terms of sort of modern variations, you know, I do like them, but I don't know if I could justify the price for what they are. I mean, yes, it's a Rolex, but I'd rather spend that sum of money on the Calatrava that I mentioned to you, Zach, on the last podcast. I mean, also, I don't really get the date window as well. So if they did one without one, then that would be great. Though there is a special edition one that I do really like, and that's called the Sea Shepherd, and it's almost got like an aventurine dial. It's almost like specks of stardust sort of on the watch, and it makes me sort of think longingly back to those Smith watches recently that's got the aventurine dial. It's actually got a moon phase in it as well, which I think is sort of simply gorgeous. I think it's called the Challenge. And I think having one of these will make you stand out of the crowd over sort of a simple sub. You know, Hamish, Ed, what do you think about the Submariner? Have you got one? Have you had one? Would you get one?
They're not the watch for me. I can understand why people like them. You know, it's the ultimate in kind of stainless steel sports watch. Like Hamish, if I would have one, I would have a solid gold one or one of the really quirky numbers like a Surtee dial, which is a emerald indices dial with like a sort of champagne-y background, but no, not a modern or even vintage sub.
Zach, what about you?
I feel like
Submariner, yes or no?
Yeah, I feel like they're like a great utility watch. Yeah, although they're often worn to the office and back by most owners. I do prefer like the GMTs because I feel like they offer a bit of a variation as well, a bit more flair than the standard sub. Although I don't want to discredit the sub because, like you mentioned, it is an iconic, iconic model, and it does have a great history within film and sports.
Cool. We're going to touch on the Daytona. I'm going to commit another deadly sin for watch collectors and say I just don't get the hype for it. Cue the pitchforks again. Yeah. You know, I respect history, you know, and I know this watch has tons of it, don't get me wrong. But let's talk about things I like. I like the panda or reverse panda, you know, white or black or black or white sort of sub dials. And I really like the sub dial sort of numeric font that they have, especially in the Paul Newman models. But I just can't get over why someone would spend that vast amount of money on it. There are other watches there that I'd rather, if I had that money, I'd spend it on something else. I mean, what do others think? Zach, first, perhaps, what do you think about the Daytonas?
Well, I would say I am a fan of the Rolex Daytonas. I wouldn't think of it as a number one model, but I do kind of like the reference 16275, the Patrizzi dial. For a portion of time, I worked at watch collecting, and they kind of sell luxury watches online, and the Patrizzi dial was a watch. Patrizzi dial Daytona specifically was a watch that was in great demand, and I kind of fell in love with it, kind of loving the contrast between the sub dials, the white sub dials, and that had a bit of patina, and the black main dial. Also, the kind of panda and kind of reverse panda have been crazy, as you guys know. I remember one point they kind of hit 37k, which is absurd. I kind of feel like they're like a bit of a unicorn when it comes to trying to acquire one from ADs, because I do have a friend that's kind of like viciously trying to figure out if he can get one of those, or maybe potentially one of the Daytonas on an Oyster Flex, which probably would be more likely than that panda. Also, I kind of like within the Daytonas, I mentioned Oyster Flex. I kind of like the casualness of the rubber strap, mixed with a kind of more sophisticated bezeled case. So I kind of like that when it comes to Daytonas. But how about you guys? What's your thoughts on the Daytona?
Yeah, have I committed sacrilege, Hamish?
No. I mean, they're a very famous watch for reasons that aren't that clear. Like, the history of it is slightly baffling. Basically became famous because a load of Italian dealers really hyped it up, and then it took off from there. I mean, it spent its first 10 years struggling to sell anything. Then they moved to the Zenith automatic movements, which are kind of, to me, they're the nicest ones. They're a great movement because it's got Zenith El Primero chronograph movement in it, with a nice, thin, fairly elegant case, but still with the classic Daytona screw down crown and pushers. Modern Daytonas are really quite chunky. They're there to be seen, and that's why they're so popular. But I don't think there's anything wrong with saying you don't really like them. And Rolex has deliberately reduced the number they make. They used to make 22 different variations as few as 4 years ago in catalog. So they've deliberately reduced the number of references, and deliberately probably also reduced production to enjoy the hype and keep raising the price. So, you know, it's a bit of a funny one. Rolex have no history in chronographs. They didn't have any history in chronographs. They made a grand total of about 2,000 before they launched the Daytona, and it wasn't very successful when it was first launched in the 60s. And what really made the watch take off was putting a Zenith movement in it. So the history of it is really strange. But now, fashion is fashion, and it's really popular. So happy days for those who like it. But to me, I've never been that interested, and it entertains me, the history and popularity of that watch.
I'm really glad that you said your favourite was probably the one with the Zenith El Primero movement in, because like magic, the watch I'm wearing today is a Zenith El Primero from the decades that they were making the movements and the cases for the Rolex Daytona. So this is a slim Daytona in solid yellow gold. It costs less than a Datejust. It's a lovely watch. And I have seen a modern Daytona, which I loved. Like, it made me get them as a watch. And ironically, it wasn't a steel one. It was a white gold one that one of our members actually got from an AD. And I think that for me is like really sums up the paradox of Rolex. Yeah, they make great sports watches, but the best one, like the most fun ones they make, are the solid gold ones. Which are totally not practical for sports anyway.
There we go. One out of four then out of us. So moving on just very quickly, we're coming to the end of the Rolex section. I really like the Milgauss that they do. So it's the one watch I really like. The original version, I think, is a thing of beauty, and it recently sold for silly money, sort of, you know, doing a bit of Google desk research for this podcast. I think the most recent one sold for $2.5 million, which again is very silly money. But you know, as listeners know, I'm very drawn to second hands, lollipop being king, but this one's got almost like a zigzag sort of lightning bolt, you know, Zeus's lightning bolt, if you will. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's my favorite detail on a watch ever. I absolutely love it. And the vintage one also has got the red triangle in the 12th position as well. I think they should really bring that design back. It would even destroy the Submariner for me, I think, having that sort of lightning bolts. I mean, the modern variants are quite sort of understated, and they sort of, you know, slightly sort of off colorings, which are a disappointment compared to the original. They're still pretty cool, if you ask me. Zach, what do you think about the lightning bolt? Have I gone a bit crazy again?
No, I think you're right with that one. I quite like that, the lightning bolt on the third hand. I feel like it's a real unique feature. I feel like when it comes to Rolex, a lot of their work is quite conservative and same-ish, but the lightning bolt does make that Milgauss stand out a bit more. But I must be honest and mention, out of all the models, I'm not completely crazy with the Milgauss. But yeah, there's other models that probably resonate with me slightly more. But how about you, gents? Is there anything else? What's your thoughts when it comes to that Milgauss model?
For me, I really like the funny little design quirks, like the green glass and the lightning bolt hand here. Those are great. I think cases maybe slightly too big, but you know, it is what Rolex does very well. It's a watch for a job, you know, anyone that works near magnets, and it's incredibly good for that. I have a few friends that have them, and I've worn them on loan for a little while, and slightly too big for me, but I can see why people like them.
Not the 2.5 million one. You'd have very interesting friends if you did. Very good, very good. And I've got one last thing to say about Rolex, and that's one of the dials that I particularly like, and that's the Californian dial. I'm not going to include a specific referenced one, but it's just sort of the design that they produced way back when. And if those don't know who it is, or what it is rather, it's, you know, it's got the top half of the face with Roman numerals and the bottom half sort of caters with Arabic ones. I've got zero idea on how or why this was a thing. Hamish, you might be able to inform us, but you know, it's very quirky and neat, if you ask me. I think Rolex should do it again and roll it out for a modern range, as opposed to churning out the same stuff year on year. Like I said, if they made one for 2025, I might consider buying one. Hamish, I'll start with you first. Do you like the California dial?
I do like it, and I think it's really of its time and place. It was an interesting design, as far as I understand it, for extra visibility in some military watches. And then there's a bit of controversy about how real they were and how many were on service dials. And I did find a very definitive sounding blog post on the whole matter, which I can try and find and send you so you can put it in the show notes. And I need to re-find anyway so it can be on our resources page, which is on our website. But they won't bring it back, obviously, because they are too conservative for that in terms of dial design. But I really like it, and there's a lot of watches with it now from other brands. So if you really like it, go and get one of those. And you can get original ones nice. For like a few grand. So they might not be an original dial, but you can get an old Rolex with that dial. But with, you know, finding one that you knew was real is exceptionally difficult.
Nice. What about you, Zach?
I kind of feel like a new modern Rolex with a California dial would be a great proposition. But like you mentioned, that it seems like that isn't on Rolex's current trajectory. But they're great at the fundamentals, Rolex, but definitely not the right brand when it comes to pushing boundaries creatively as of like recent. So yeah, I don't kind of see that happening, but I guess at least we have the older models to kind of look at and marvel over.
So there you have it. So that concludes, you know, sort of the Rolex section. You know, I really want a lightning bolt secondhand and a California dial. It will never happen because Rolex is so conservative and sort of frozen to the spot. But hell, maybe Tudor will decide to do it. So we can always ask their little brother if they want it. Right, we're going to move to the sort of the last section of our show, and we'll counter through that. And it's about bracelets. So I do worry this episode is going to be a bit of a pile on what I don't particularly like. But in fairness, obviously, you know, everyone has to have a voice. So we'll start with Oyster. Zach, are you a fan of the Oyster bracelet?
The answer to that is yes, I am a fan of Oyster bracelets. I kind of enjoy the simplicity, the robustness, I think Ed mentioned about Rolex being robust, or maybe it's Hamish, forgive me if I'm wrong. I also have a kind of like a new kind of like fondness towards them because of the recent watch I have, which I mentioned before, the OP Reference 1500. And it kind of led me to getting that that particular watch, because I guess with the date, just the most of the ones I've seen were on the Jubilee. So yeah, I think they work well, and I'm quite fond of them. How about you, Tim?
I don't mind Oyster bracelets. I got one on my Seamaster 300. However, I think if it was sort of brushed steel, given all the scratches that I've got on mine already, I think that's probably where I would go. What about Jubilee, Zach? Do you like the Jubilee style bracelet?
I'll say with the Jubilee bracelets were initially my favourite, like I've already kind of touched on. But I've slowly drifted over to Oysters, especially anything on the 34, 36 millimeter, as the expectation is for those size watches to be on a Jubilee usually. So I kind of like the uniqueness of having a smaller watch on an Oyster, because most modern Rolexes are on Oysters. So I like going against the grain when it comes to that. How about you, Tim?
What can I say? So I look back to bracelets, and all I can think of is my dad wearing them sort of in sort of the late 80s, early 90s. They look so retro, but not in a good way. And as I said earlier, did anything look good in the 80s? I just can't get on with many bracelets, really. But like I said, each to their own. Can I have a passionate defence for one of you guys? I'm certainly willing to listen, Ed, Hamish.
Yeah, I think once you've tried on a Audemars Piguet Royal Oak, you'll be converted to bracelets. the greatest bracelet ever made.
Well, indeed, when we did that sort of interview on your watch, and I tried it on, I did respect and see why that one was definitely it. But for the whole of them, more broadly, I'm yet to be convinced.
Yeah, I think that same watch I tried on, but to be fair, the only difference is I already knew that I loved integrated bracelets, so it kind of probably just reaffirmed that with Ed's Royal Oak.
I just like the variety. Like, it's a real technical challenge to make a different bracelet. Ultimately, the ones that you see on many steel watches from many different brands are all kind of similar, because that's the most efficient and cost effective to make. But when brands try interesting things, you get some cracking bracelets. As Ed said, the Royal Oak bracelet's pretty famous for its different hinges, especially in, and then lots of bracelets in different bimetals and things like that. And then the jewelry bracelets, which are sort of more like mystery designs, so you can't really see how they're designed, and mesh designs. So I think they're really wonderful. I don't wear too many. I'm a strap guy, more of a vintage watch guy, and so I like a watch on a strap, like you, Tim. But bracelets, yeah, I think they can be a lot of fun, and they can feel more. They do feel more sporty. They may feel more active, depending on, you know. I've got a steel G-Shock with a steel bracelet. I love the feeling of wearing that. That's a digital watch, so on a steel bracelet. So yeah, I think they're great fun, and I think to the Rolex bracelets, the Rolex Jubilee in white gold is rightly famous. You know, the Jubilee is a very famous bracelet, and in gold it really makes people feel good. You know, I think it does shine. You know, it's supposed to shine, to your point, and that's why people like it.
So we've got one more I'm going to highlight, and then we're going to draw it to a close. So it's the sort of Millenet sort of mesh style. So it's actually a bracelet that I actually like. Hooray. I think it links back to that sort of like 007 sort of Star Watch. You know, I don't really like how bracelets actually look, and this style is completely different. You know, it, like I said, it looks almost like mesh or chainmail. I would strongly consider adding the official sort of Omega one they have for the Bond Seamaster. But it's sort of silly buggers in terms of price, and I heard it doesn't actually fit very well, and the clasp sort of sticks out a bit at the back. There are cheaper sort of non-official ones, but I don't think they, you know, doesn't really do it though if you can't get the official Omega one. There is an IWC one which I think looks superb, but again the price is double, treble what the Omega one is. You could buy another watch for it really. But one day I think I'll sort of venture into the sort of mesh straps. But I think I need to try the Omega one sort of when I pop in the store a bit later on. Zach, what do you think? Do you like those mesh style bracelets?
Yeah, I kind of feel like it's not something that I've looked in specifically for any watches that I'd go for. But I do appreciate the one, like you mentioned, on the Bond Seamaster, like on your 300. I do kind of feel like it offers something different, and I kind of feel like what Hamish mentioned about variation, you know, kind of like, yeah, it offers something different and it suits specific watches. So I think with the right watch, probably yes. But I feel like currently or in the past, I don't think I've like gone for a mesh or Milanese strap or bracelet. But how about you guys? Do you have any watches on the Milanese mesh straps or?
Yeah, I've got a couple actually. I like it as I like bracelets on watches. So, you name the pattern, I've got it. So the Milanese is for me a lovely kind of summery strap. You know, they're quite fit, they're quite heavy, but they've got a real kind of outdoorsy beachside diving vibe, which I really like. They're not all created equal. So a really well-made one doesn't pinch your hairs, doesn't pinch your skin. A poorly made one does, and I've got both. But a really nicely made one with a well-fitting clasp is a joy to wear. It's like, as Hamish said, the Jubilee from Rolex. It's famous for a reason. It's incredibly comfortable. It's noticeable. It's a great, great bracelet.
Yeah, if you want to explore those bracelets more, Tim, the Omega mesh bracelets are supplied by a German supplier.
Okay.
Also sell them direct.
Okay, I'll just check into that. And
you can have a Google around, and I think you'll soon find the strap maker, the bracelet maker I'm talking about, and then you'll find the prices are a bit different if you buy direct from them.
I'll speak to you afterwards.
And yeah, to anyone listening, that's how the watch world works. Like components, specialized components are made by specialist manufacturers, and nowadays some of those manufacturers also sell direct, but they are the same product, albeit without the relevant clasp, which you know you might want. But it's worth having a look around. I like mesh bracelets a lot. I don't actually have one in my collection, and I see that as an oversight. So I just have to sort of choose a watch. The watch I was wearing today is a gift, a micro brand watch from Singapore as a gift for my birthday, and that would look fantastic on a mesh strap. So maybe that's my next purchase.
Yeah, brilliant. Wonderful. So that concludes sort of the episode. Thank you again for keeping time with us. It's always a pleasure to chat with both Ed and Hamish, and this time have it recorded and shared with you all. If we could cork their passion, zeal and knowledge for watches and sell it to the community, I think the watch world would be an even greater place. So definitely a seal of approval from myself and Zach. Personally, I really want to see the Watch Collectors Club go from strength to strength and gain more members. You want to hit that 1,000. I hope you do that soon. As I said before, it's such a sort of chilled out group. No airs and graces. It's not stuffy at all. It's great for new and old hands as well. So next time, we're going to turn to a growing favourite of both Zach and I, and that's Panerai. Zach, you mentioned earlier you had the opportunity to attend an event there and was pleasantly surprised. We want to hear more about that. So until next time, fellow timekeepers, you know where to find us on social media. And obviously you've got me at WatchWords and Zach at Source Watches. So goodbye and over and out. Thank you.